It's not Christian nationalism, though. Those are the other people. We're not Christian nationalists, but we do want to shape our to reshape our
nation under Christianity.
That's right.
It's just a leftist Christianity.
Welcome to the Stand Firm podcast. We are recording this episode on Tuesday, February 18th, 2025. I'm Nick Lannon of Grace Anglican Church in Louisville, Kentucky, and I'm here as always with Matt Kennedy of the Anglican Church of the Good Shepherd in Binghamton, New York, and J.D. Koch of St. Luke's Anglican Church on Hilton Head Island, South Carolina. How are you fellas doing today?
Thank you. I'm doing wonderful.
Great, Nick. Thanks.
So the Stand Firm universe lost a dear friend this week, Johnny Simmons, music director at Church of the Holy Spirit, Reformed Episcopal Church in Houston. Matt, you knew him. Would you care to share a few words about Johnny with our listener?
Yeah, I mean, it's not just me. I think we've been seeing people know Johnny from all over the Anglican world. Some he has had so much influence on so many people. Just his joy for the gospel, his love of music. His willingness at the drop of a hat to stop what he's doing and help you figure something out. Like when COVID hit, for example, when we had to figure out how to do live streaming at our church, I knew he was much more of a tech guy than I was. So I called him up and he spent hours with us, with my tech people and myself. Well, not really with me, cause I didn't know what he's talking about, but with the people in my sphere who know what he's talking about, helping us set something up so we can continue, or we could start a live stream. But he did that kind of thing. If he knew you were in need of any kind, he would offer his expertise. He would offer his help. He would teach. He taught people, you know, he gave people drum lessons online for free. He was just an all around, people have been saying, using the phrase joyful warrior about him, because he so willingly sacrificed himself for other people. And he was a stalwart when it comes to defending the gospel and biblical truth. I think I first met him online back in 2000 and right after the Gene Robinson thing, 2003, 2004. There was a White Horse Tavern email listserv back in the old days, and he was on it, and that's where I first made his acquaintance. And he's from, I think it's probably a lot of the guys who were on that listserv still remember him warmly. And I think if you're listening, you know, really, well, if you're hearing me say this, you're listening. But I would say, please pray for Jenny, his wife. This is so sudden. I mean, there's nothing. No one expected this. This is not a succumbing to a long term sickness or some kind of gradual descent and unhealth. He really, it was a sudden collapse and death. And so everyone's shocked. You can pray for his whole congregation is in mourning. Pray for Jenny, especially. Father Carl Lund, who's his pastor, is also really reeling as well. They were very close friends, best friends. So the whole community's at a loss, and we are too. He's been a very strong supporter of Stand Firm from the beginning, back in the old Stand Firm days, and in the present. Yeah. He listens. And he's shared our stuff, and so just thankful for him. And he's with the Lord now, and so he has no more sorrow or pain. But Jenny does, and so does the rest of us. So please do keep them all in your prayers.
Amen.
Mm-hmm. Amen.
Well, I guess there's no smooth transition into a weekly podcast episode, but here we go. I do feel like I need to give fair warning to our listener. I'm personally having internet issues at my house, like Matt did last week, so I'm running this podcast from the hotspot on my phone. We'll see how this goes. But anyway, this week we thought we would talk about the decline, or at least the alleged decline, of big evangelical institutions. We're thinking specifically of things like Christianity Today, the Gospel Coalition, Wheaton College. And it's Wheaton that's specifically on the hot seat right now, having recently apologized for a tweet congratulating a graduate on a senior posting in the Trump administration. There's a petition online right now asking Wheaton for new leadership to end their DEI programs, to audit their staff and faculty members' commitment to their statement of faith, and more. So, guys, is the drift of these institutions real? One, and if so, is it an artifact of the racial reckoning of the George Floyd summer of 2020, or does the situation as it stands now originate before that?
I mean, I think it seems to originate before that. If you read the alumni letter, for example, that they sent, that the alumni, this group of alumni, not all the alumni, but this group of alumni sent to Wheaton, man, it reads like the Episcopal Church 2014, basically, and you don't get there overnight. So this sounds like a long, slow descent into
madness,
into deep, deep wokeness. And it was, just tick all of the boxes about all the social gospel boxes, in which every leftist policy for dealing with things like poverty or immigration or whatever it might be is associated as if it's one-to-one with the gospel. So, you know, democratic policies for immigration, that is the gospel. If you don't support those policies, you don't support the gospel. And it's just like that all the way through this letter. It could have been written by, again, TC 2014, or just get one of the NGOs who have been funded by USA. They would have written something of this nature. So it's gotten a lot of traction. Like a lot of alumni have apparently signed this. And then here's the thing that they're objecting to. The reason that the I think I'll read it so people can, if they haven't read it, know how terrible this tweet was by Wheaton to cause such a firestorm of controversy. They tweeted, Wheaton College congratulates and prays for 1998 graduate Russell Vogt. I'm not sure how to pronounce his name. Regarding his senatorial confirmation to serve as the White House Director of the Office of Management and Budget. That's it.
That's it.
That's Christian nationalism right there.
That's even more vanilla than I remember it after being.
Well, they have a picture of his face. He's smiling. And it's under the official Wheaton College X site. But so it took all of, like, well, I think 24 hours for there to be such an uproar on the part of people who attended Wheaton that they decided to pull it down. They didn't have to. They decided to pull it down, and they posted this instead. On Friday, Wheaton College posted a congratulations and a call to prayer for an alumnus who received confirmation to a White House post. The recognition and prayer is something we would typically do for any graduate student or graduate who reached that level of government. However, the political situation surrounding the appointment led to a significant concern expressed online. It was not our intention to embroil the college in a political discussion or dispute. Our institutional and theological commitments are clear that the college as a nonprofit institution does not make political endorsements. Wheaton College's focus is on Christ and his kingdom. There was nothing about that original post that was an endorsement of Donald Trump or of his administration. All it was a congratulations for a guy who was elevated to a pretty high position in the administration by Senate confirmation. And yeah. So it wasn't just, he's not just a Trump guy. He's also been confirmed by the U.S. Senate constitutionally. And it was saying, hey, pray for this guy. What's wrong? How?
It's such a sad, sad lack of leadership and courage there. I mean, I think, you know, I have a friend of mine that went to Wheaton and they said they had great hopes that Phil Ryken was going to right the ship, you know, and stop the decline. And, you know, I think that, you know, certainly what's been coming out doesn't seem like that has been happening. And this just confirms because at some point you imagine this decision had to get for him, you know, to make something like this knowing that it was so public. And the fact that it was so quickly done and so, and like we pointed out, I mean, so over something that, you know, you could say about it, a sworn enemy, even, you know, I mean, you could have said that about, you know, you're praying for, you know, our enemy, the, you know, I mean, who knows? I mean, it's really just sad. And it's just another, as you said, indicator of kind of the lack of courage and sort of mainline evangelicalism to stand up against any criticism. And it was really sad to see. And I'm glad that this, my, you know, for Wheaton is at the website, the sort of pushing back, like we said, the alumni are getting together and fighting for it. You know, it reminds me of what the alumni at Yale should have done when, what's his name, William F. Buckley wrote God and Man at Yale, after having graduated to the, he wrote that in large part to the trustees, saying, you know, this is your responsibility is to hold the line here and not let the woke, well, he didn't say woke, but the progressive students and faculty take control of the organization. But that's precisely what they did, and that's what they're doing. And it's just now it's made its way from mainline sort of Ivy League institutions down to the the Christian Ivies, as it were. And it's unsurprising. I mean, you know, we've seen people coming out of these places for decades, and it's not surprising that this would be the general reaction, at least given my interaction with many of them. Not all, but many. And you know, it's just it's nice to see all these things done in secret come to light.
The letter that was written by the alumni who are opposed to the original tweet, I'm trying to count the paragraphs here. It's super long. Compared to the one paragraph tweet, there's so much verbiage here. And I'll just read you one section because it gives you an indication of where this is coming from. Vogt, he authored an article or a section of the 2025 project. So that already is going to trigger like bunches of people who have no idea what the 2025 project is, except for what they've heard on CNN. They haven't actually read it. But if you read what he wrote, basically he was arguing for the executive branch to take control of the executive branch, for the executive to take control of the executive branch, so that you don't have a bloated bureaucracy kind of working independently and doing their own thing.
Yeah, fourth branch. That's right.
Yeah. So he's saying that was his article. It was basically a restatement of Madison, one of Madison's arguments in the Federalist Papers. So it was totally unremarkable as far as arguments go in our nation. He wasn't saying I'm a Christian nationalist or anything like that. He's making a basically constitutional argument for the cutting down of bureaucracy. And in response, so let me read you some of the headings. Christianity, this is from the letter in response, Christianity and the temptation of totalitarianism. Project 2025 is a blueprint for consolidating executive power to remake American government and society along rigid ideological lines. The plan proposes dismantling independent institutions, purging thousands of career civil servants in favor of political loyalists, and centralizing authority in one person. Yeah, it's in the executive branch. The authority should be centralized under the executive. That's why it's called the executive branch. And I guarantee you that that if this had not been done, if President Trump had not been going in and trying to call out all the bloat, the minute, say, the Justice Department or the State Department makes a wrong step, the press will be screaming about Trump's State Department or Trump's Judicial Department, because while Trump should have no authority to do anything in those departments, he bears the ultimate responsibility for everything that's done. That's the unfairness of the whole thing. That's the ridiculousness of the whole thing. But okay, so more of these headlines, or more of these titles of sections. Marginalization of the vulnerable. All right, so here's how that works. So gutting protections for undocumented immigrants and refugees, despite scripture's consistent call to welcome those same persons and condemnation of figures who do not. Dismantling civil rights protection, dismissing the reality of racial injustice and refusing to seek the biblical vision of reconciliation and justice. I bet you that has to do with undoing DEI, because in their minds, DEI is racial reconciliation. And then one of my favorites is rolling back opportunities and protections for people with disabilities and LGBTQ individuals, failing to treat all people with the dignity and respect that every image bearer of God deserves. And I guarantee you that has to do with no longer having pronoun hospitality in our government institutions and telling people they can't, men can't parade around in dresses in front of little children or walk into girls' locker rooms and shower with them. So that, but when you do that, according to these people, you are failing to treat all people with the dignity and respect of every, that every image bearer of God deserves. So just go down the line. This is why I'm sounding maybe crazy here, but I feel like I'm being gaslit, because this is has nothing to do with Christianity or the gospel, but they're of course couching it in gospel terms. And it just, it's such a display of how far down what was once a mainstream, mainline evangelical institution, how far it's fallen and become just gutted to its core by this woke mind virus, to use whoever was that, is that Elon Musk uses that phrase, but that's what this is.
Well, and it's just, I mean, we've seen this before. I mean, we've talked about this, I think, in a version of it every single show for 200 plus shows. But, you know, we've watched this before, and we've been warning people because it was the same trajectory as we saw in the Episcopal Church, same trajectory we've seen in the mainline institutions. And there was supposed to be a firewall, you know, namely the scriptures and between the culture and these Christian institutions. And it's just, as you said, been revealed that it has not just infiltrated, but become one and the same. You know, I mean, these are just talking points for progressive political action committees that are cloaked with biblical reference. And who was it that said something like, someone on Twitter said that these were moralistic scolds, you know, and I thought that was a good word for it. It's just sort of another, you know, self-righteous preening from social sort of activists, you know, social gospel activists. I mean, this is just what this is. And so the long history of this, you know, going back in American progressive Christianity, easily back into the late 19th century, you know, certainly, and we've seen it, we've lived it, and we've watched it. And it's just tragic that that these once courageous institutions that have done such good, you know, Wheaton and Christianity Today. And I mean, I don't think many other Christian colleges would, maybe I don't know all of them, obviously, but it seems to me that most Christian colleges, rather than, or the majority, seem to be producing Christians like this, or at least people that would side with these people objecting to vote as opposed to standing up for them, at least as far as I can tell from the discourse and the just personal interaction I've had. I mean, it's anecdotal, but it's you know, it's what I go on. And what makes me remember that Mark Galley, I tried to find it. Remember when Mark Galley left Christianity Today and he converted to Catholicism and he wrote that sort of expose about the rot that he participated in? It was a little bit of a mea culpa. And he mentioned how, you know, for decades, the quote unquote evangelicals have been sidling up with the, what Schleiermacher would call the culture despisers, you know, and they were sort of downplaying creation, you know, in whatever form you want to sort of argue for it, you know, downplaying complementarianism, as it would come to be known, you know, the differences between men and women, like downplaying traditional Christian convictions that were going contrary, particularly to the post-60s sexual revolution egalitarian world. And I thought, you know, are there more people like him in these institutions? That's always been the question, you know, because they are being run. It's just like we talked about last week. You know, there's somebody, their courage will beget courage at some point in these institutions, or they'll cease to exist, you know. And so we pray for the reversal. It's like with the Episcopal Church, you know, I'd love nothing more than for the next presiding bishop to fall to his knees and just say, we were wrong, you know, like, Lord, have mercy. You know, that would be amazing. And perhaps that'll happen. But in the event that something like that doesn't happen, then this progressive march or lurching towards moralistic Unitarianism at best is not going to be stopped. And so, you know, I wonder what point on the deconstruction timeframe, you know, many of these sort of Wheaton grads who are objecting to this are on. I wonder where they are. I mean, they're not yet at the, is it Barnabas Piper? Who's the Piper that, that so angry, and they're not yet at the Derek Webb stage, but they're at some point on this trajectory. If this is their self-righteous preening reaction to a duly elected graduate, whatever his politics are.
Well, you mentioned Schleiermacher and the culture despisers, and we've long argued that the reason, sort of the tipping point for these institutions, was the desire for relevance amongst the elites. The interesting thing is, this is a senior post in the American government. This is pretty darn elite in normal world. This is seemingly the exact kind of placement that an institution that wants to sidle up to the elites wants to have. They want to have this sort of insider access. So is it Trump that's specifically non-elite? Like, he's so objectionable that even an elite posting that's connected to him? Or is it somehow Republicanism more broadly, conservatism more broadly? Because theoretically, this is the exact kind of thing that institutions that want elite status would want.
Well, I mean, you can't avoid, you can't avoid seeing the classism that underlies a lot of this. It doesn't matter if Trump, President Trump, has power. It doesn't matter if he elevates people who are our, you know, have Christian backgrounds to positions of actual political power, because they're the wrong sorts of people. I mean, their associations are with the unwashed, the ignorant.
So it's just that he's gauche. Like,
exactly. It's not the power.
Yeah, he's tacky.
It's
man.
If you're not, you know, they really crave the actual, in their minds, elite, which means it can't be people who are reactionary, conservative. The elite is always on the progressive side from this mindset, because it's always pushing for more revolution. And so those are the people on the cutting edge of the arc of history. And if you want to be on the cutting edge of the arc of history yourself, you've got to be with them. You've got to attract them. You've got to draw them into your orbit, or be drawn into their orbit, which is what happens instead. And so that's why, I mean, people have remarked on this for years, but that's why the church, at least the leftist liberal church or the evangelical church that's trying to attract the elites, that's why you're always like 5 or 10 years behind the latest thing. Right. So we might be looking at we talked about this last week, but we might be looking at a genuine culture shift in the United States, where the culture actually does become more conservative and more friendly toward Christianity. But these guys are still back in 2020. Right. They're still back in George Floyd day, and they're not going to catch up to this. And I'm not sure if they'll ever be able to adjust to that kind of change, because they've invested themselves, if it goes this way, because they've invested themselves so heavily in being attractive to leftist elite, that they don't see the non-Christian conservative right as a mission field. I think they've adopted the leftist ideological view of them as the deplorables, the people who are just, you know, they're worthless, and we don't reach out to them because we really don't want them in our churches. That would make us look bad. If we had a whole bunch of Appalachians come into our church, we would chase out all the really intellectual and superior people. So we don't want that. We would rather them, you know, go to their own podunk churches out in the sticks rather than
go back to their shanties. Shoot them again. Right. That's right.
Exactly. Let them go back and handle their snakes, because we have cocktail hour after hour services, so that we'll have all the right people.
Yeah, that's a good question, Nick. And I think that you're exactly right, Matt. And I wonder, where is the actual seat? Like, who are the people represented for these people that would, like, their kind of approval would be like the final victory, like the final boss in the game? I just don't know who, you know, is it sort of academic elites? Is it leftist cultural elites? Is it, you know, European globalists? Like, I don't really know, because, you know, the narrative that was being fostered by the Democrats, at least, you know, so heavily, has not only been not been rejected, but it's been doubled down on, you know. So it's clearly they're still operating in many ways on, you know, all of the sort of rights language, all the victim and power language, all this stuff. And so I wonder, from a Christian perspective, like, who are they? Like, whose approval are they seeking? You know, like the Holy Post podcast people, like, are they hoping to become, you know, like the presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church? Are they trying to become, you know,
they're trying to get invited to broadcast live from Davos?
Yeah, maybe. That might be it. Instead of kicked out, like.
Remember how happy they were, though, when Francis Collins was there in the limelight? And so all the winsome pastors made sure to have him come on to their church and, you know, speak to their people. And then he went on all the podcasts, and man, the leftist evangelicals, the platformed evangelicals, were super happy about that. That was, I think, if you're talking about the final goal, I think they were sensing victory during the Biden years, because they were able to get their people into pretty high spots and influential positions with regard to not just Francis Collins, but, you know, Russell Moore had a huge platform to speak to people on the left. The whole after party program was to try and consolidate that, under the assumption that the Democrats would win. the presidency. And say he saw 4 more years of maybe if Kamala Harris as president would be 4 more years to get more of their people into these positions of power, not just power, but elitist status. And I think they're in their minds, I don't think they had bad intentions necessarily. They're probably thinking, and this is how we can make sure we get the gospel to these people. This is how we can influence our nation to be just and righteous and good. It's not Christian nationalism, though. Those are the other people. We're not Christian nationalists, but we do want to shape our to reshape our nation
under Christianity.
That's right.
It's just a leftist Christianity. If they hadn't lost this election, I think they would have felt like they had a point of they almost won the heights.
Where do you think the first step takes place? I mean, you know, if you go back to the modernist fundamentalist debates in the turn of the 20th century, at least, you see the argument over supernaturalism, sort of the seedbed that began to sort of fracture, you know, people questioning the authority of scripture, the authorship of the various epistles, the timeline of the Old Testament, creation, the virgin birth, all these things. And I think there's something to that hypothesis. Lisa Machen thought so, you know, that this is where the rot started to take place and take hold in the heart. And I think that, because I wonder about this a lot, because I know we know some of these type people, you know, having been in the serving in the Episcopal Church. And, you know, I know, and I don't have a, you know, that, well, with few exceptions, they're not, you know, seven headed, you know, monsters that are out to do evil. Like they genuinely think this is loving, kind, compassionate, and good. And they often evince a real ignorance of the opposite argument, you know, real, like a, it's either been, you know, highly would say straw man, never steel man, as they say, but, or just flat wrong, you know, like, and so that was part of it, I think, is the ignorance of your opponent, which is a scene. But I do wonder where it begins and how is it corrected? You know, I mean, that's one of the, like, when you find yourself in the situation of reacting like this to innocuous prayer, Russell Vogt, like, are you too far gone?
It's an interesting sort of parabolic curve, isn't it? Because what you described, the sort of hesitance about supernaturalism, does seem to be the starting point in the culture. But for an institution or for an evangelical individual, it's more like the end point than the starting point, because I'm sure Wheaton would affirm everything that you listed, like the physical resurrection, the creation, all the moral stuff. They're on the parabola, like getting closer to where the culture started, which was the denial of all those things. So I'm not exactly sure sort of what the starting point is, other than just the desire, as we've said a million times, to be more acceptable to the culture. You're sort of moving toward the center as the culture. It's sort of, you know, the age old, if you're negotiating with somebody who's not moving and you like move a little more every time, like that's not a negotiation, that's a surrender.
Yeah, interesting. Look, it's a really interesting point, Nick. And I think you're exactly right. I mean, who was it? I forget who was had the historicity of American evangelicalism. Maybe it was in the dispensationalist book I read. It doesn't matter. But the point was saying that, you know, the early evangelicals like sort of had thick skin because they were prepared to be rejected by society because they, you know, they were like, those are those nutballs who believe in, you know, literal resurrection, a virgin birth and heaven and hell and all this stuff. And so they were insulated. And a lot of these institutions were founded during that time by people who had no, well, I mean, they had sort of come to grips with the fact that they were going to be these alternative narrative, you know, institutions, you know, over against Harvard and Yale and Brown. And they actually pointed to those schools as having, you know, case in point of what happens when you let liberalism in the door, you know. And so then you had the second and third generation, which we're a part of now, you know, fourth generation. And as we get further away from the fire of the founding, as it were, then it begins to sort of get less hot, I mean, to stick with the metaphor. And so now the assumption of the children of Wheaton graduates is not that they would be maligned or ostracized, but they would be, you know, rejected. They would be accepted into the halls of power and academia or whatever industry they went into. And so, you know, most industries will allow you to be a Christian, but not a genuine evangelical Christian. You know, you could be a, you can, unless you work for Chick-fil-A, I guess, but like, you know, or Hobby Lobby, but you know, most times, most people wouldn't go into a, like a.
And those aren't elite institutions. Those aren't the halls of power.
I know. I remember with a dear friend of ours, I did a literal Christian, I mean, I did a worship service to open and bless a Chick-fil-A service. And I was just sitting there aghast thinking like I was breaking every law in the state. And come to find out, you can still do things like this. You know, it was very, actually I have a constitutional law friend of mine who does a lot of religious liberty stuff, and I've had him come and address groups at times just to lay out exactly what you can do legally, like just so you know, but you have to be ready to fight, you know, you have to be ready to get hit. And that's what no one wants to do. And I think that what we see at Wheaton is that not only do the students not want to be associated with anything that might get them, well, for lack of a better word, hit, but certainly the faculty, and then obviously many of the alum don't want to be put in any sort of orbit where they might be associated with this lightning rod, which is, you know, Donald Trump and his executive power. And so it's sad. It's sad to watch because, you know, I don't take any joy. It's like with the Roman Catholic Church. Like, I'm not a Roman Catholic. I have a lot of objections to it, but I certainly consider many of the people in it compatriots and brothers and sisters in the same general cultural battle we find ourselves in. And I certainly like to think of that as Wheaton College and the graduates and the professors and things, but it's increasingly less the case as a given than it has been my entire life. You know, we saw it a couple months ago when they took down the Jim Elliot plaque, you know, because it mentioned him witnessing to the savages. I think a couple years ago they had the woman wearing the hijab in class, and they, you know, they had some fights about that. And, you know, there's been a long, slow march, lurch leftward. And I don't know, you know, given that list of the objections, I'm not sure how much further it could even go before it becomes just another in name only Christian leftist institution, like many of the other formerly evangelical schools.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that brings up, well, it doesn't bring up, you mentioned earlier, the lack of courage here on the part of the administration, the Wheaton administration. The only way, Joe Rignita does such a great job talking about this, the only way an institution doesn't end up capitulating and trending left and then losing its bearings and becoming just another leftist institution is by being willing to say no when the concern, quote unquote, concern, emotional sabotage, concern trolls start raising their heads and say, well, I'm really, you know, I'm really upset that you have supported this racist regime headed by a rapist. You know, that's when the administration should say, well, we're not supporting the regime. We were congratulating our alumni, or the president. We were congratulating our alumni, and the post is staying up. Well, that really hurts. That makes us feel, that gives me pain. Well, I'm sorry, but you know, you can learn to live with that pain. Well, what about all the people? These people, you know, you can see the argument. You've heard the arguments. It's this the wielding of emotional pressure that so many of us have not been trained or don't have experience in resisting, that will lead to your church succumbing, your school succumbing, your whatever your family succumbing to the influence of this wokeness, because it is in large part built on untethered empathy and emotion. That by untethered, I mean untethered to the truth. So your role is, if you're a father, a pastor, the dean of a school, the teacher, is to say no and then bear up under the pressure that's going to be coming your way, the emotional pressure that's going to be coming your way. Because if you can, you can win the institution back.
Yeah.
You all know, I'm not a huge fan of Donald Trump, but I love J.D. Vance a lot. But you'll notice what he did this in the Munich conference this last week. It was a great example of how to handle emotional pressure. He went in there and he said some very hard truths to these Europeans. And man, the pressure after that on him was so great to, you know, you should take back your comments, you should apologize. You should. But no, he's not going to apologize because he spoke the truth. And so the emotional sabotage has been heaved his way, he just shrugs off like a duck shrugs off water. And that's what you have. That's a great model, regardless of what you think about the content of what he said, or there, or him as an individual, or Trump as an individual, whatever. That's a good model for how a leader should behave when pressed against, when he's facing the pressure, the emotional pressure to capitulate. I'm never given to that, because it's never enough. You give into it once, it's never enough. You'll lose your institution.
Yeah, and it bears noting that, you know, these are muscles that have to be exercised. You know, this is the hard lesson learned, at least in my life, is that not only, you know, the convictions can be there, but if they're not exercised, and you allow them to be weakened by, you know, by degrees, you know, just chipped away, even by inaction, you know, like just remaining silent or not speaking up, you know, your objection when asked for it, or at least when it would make sense to offer it, can start weakening you. You know, we've talked about this before, and I'm grateful that the Lord in my own life has ripped me out of that decline. Not the least of which, when having a child, you know, all of a sudden was like, no, wait a minute, some of these things might actually be worth fighting for, right? And I've said it before, you know, so when I didn't have children, when we first got married, I could never believe how everyone gets so exercised at a PTA meeting. You know, now it's like, well, where else should you stand up but for a PTA, or if not a PTA meeting, where, right? But I do think that's just an encouragement to other pastors and teachers and Christian people out there, is that, you know, you don't have to start with the platform that J.D. Vance has to be able to build up that sort of strength. But you can start with your own family. You can start with your own congregation. You know, start with the person who you know in your congregation has perhaps significant disagreements with you, and set up a meeting with them, you know, or at least invite that type of discussion. Because it's been my experience that the more you articulate it, then the clearer your presentation of it becomes, and the more it actually begins to become part of your, the conviction is wrought much more firmly and strongly, you know. And as the old adage goes, you know, courage begets courage. You know, you have people helping model that in your church. And that's why we talked about this at length. I'm so grateful for our College of Bishops, you know, who are stepping out in some of these contentious issues and really leading, you know, by example in some of these areas, and human sexuality, obviously, and pronoun usage and all the things, to name a few. But, you know, it's incumbent upon, I think, pastors, and then obviously fathers of pastors in their homes, to really take this responsibility seriously, because there's going to come a point where you want your children to be able to say firmly and with all humility, but nevertheless with strength, no, you know, that's not right. I don't agree with that. I don't think we should do that. In fact, I think we should do the exact opposite. And if you don't prepare them when they're young, or at least as along the way, then when that comes, more often than not, they're going to just crumble. And I think, and I do think you're right, Matt. I think that Joe Rigney book is great about emotional sabotage. And he's got a new one coming out called The Sin of Empathy, I just saw, which looks good too. It's guaranteed to agitate and annoy all of the right people. So I look forward to reading it. So.
I mean, these institutions can be recovered. We've talked several times over the years about how Southern Seminary here in Louisville made the decision at a real turning point time in the life of that school to hire Al Mohler. And you can watch his opening Q&A on YouTube and just watch the emotional struggle session that some of the students try to put him through. And he had exercised this muscle apparently enough to be able to stand firm then. And, you know, you can argue with whatever, but the Southern Seminary was in a real sense, I think, saved. And I like your analogy, JD. I was going to say something myself to the Anglican way of organizing our church, because the beauty of a good bishop is that he can stand there and say yes, or he can stand there and say no. And if he's got the spine to stick to it, he can really save a church almost all by himself. And that's a really valuable thing that we have when we have a staunch bishop at our back.
That's right.
Yeah, and so the same thing is true with our polity in the congregation. I mean, the rector, if you're a rector, you have a great deal of authority. It's actually, one professor was telling me, it was somewhat modeled on the constitutional framework, because the rector has pretty much absolute authority over the music, over the teaching, over the spiritual cure. of the parish, the only thing he doesn't have absolute authority over is the money, which is that's the check on his power is the vestry and in the parish. But you as a rector, if someone comes to you and says, well, I don't like what you're preaching, it's making me sad, it doesn't, listen to them. I mean, if they have a real good doctrinal point and you are preaching something bad, stop it. But if you're preaching the truth, then you just have the authority to say, well, I'm sorry you feel that way. And here's why I'm preaching what I'm preaching. And I love you. I hope you stay. And I hope to see you this Sunday. And that's just having the strength to do that, even in the face of tears, even when someone's crying, will breathe health into your church.
Amen. Yeah, I mean, I think, and that's just an appeal to the extent that any bishops listen to this, which I don't know if they do, but, we could, some of these cultural sort of debates that are happening around us, it's comforting for me when they clarify for us from on high what the ACNA actually stands for. I have been very much heartened by the clear statements, for instance, in our canons on abortion, natural conception to natural death, that's been useful. That we mentioned before the statement on obviously human sexuality, or gender pronoun usage and things. And so there, I've really been encouraged by that, and precisely to the point where, the bishop gets to come in once a year in sort of this, sometimes shadowy figure way far away, and can take all of the opprobrium away from you if necessary, particularly on some of these contentious issues, and I think that that's by design and helpful. And so, but I also agree with you, Matt, like you have to, as the rector, we have to take the this responsibility very seriously and be ready to, if not even just expect, that people will misunderstand, will be willfully ignorant or even malicious in their interpretation of some of the things that you say. And hopefully by the preparation for that, your response will be able to at least correct them if necessary, or receive correction when necessary. And that's, I wish that that was something they could teach in seminary, and I wish that that was something that didn't come through essentially trial and error. But unfortunately, it seems to be the case that that you have to learn these things. But it's a lesson. It's a lesson worth learning. And by God's grace, I'm grateful to believe I'm at a place where, for the most part, I could be prepared to say no when necessary. Because I've seen the converse of saying yes in wrong places, and the cure in that place is worse than the disease.
Well, a great, maybe last word here. Yeah. A great Jesus-y example of this, of Jesus resisting emotional pressures. After he had this kind of confrontation with the Pharisees, and he says to them, it's not what you put in your mouth that makes you unclean. It's what comes out of your mouth, because what comes out of your mouth comes from your heart, and the heart is full of all kinds of, adultery, sexual thoughts, all those sensual thoughts, murder. Well, he goes through the list. And then he and the disciples go back behind closed doors, and the disciples say to him, hey, did you know that you really offended the Pharisees? And it seems like, and maybe I'm reading too much into it, but it seems like it's an attempt to use some kind of, hey, you got to be careful. You don't, you need to go back and fix this, because they're going to be really upset. And Jesus says, well, I don't care. Leave them. They're blind guides. So he did not succumb for a second to the, if that was emotional pressure, to that emotional pressure, and he stayed the course. And of course, he's Jesus. So we should be like that.
He stayed the course. And of course,
go
he's
and
Jesus.
Do likewise. That's go right. And do likewise.
Well, that's a good word to end on. Always good to end on the Bible. Thanks for listening to Stand Firm this week. If you want to keep the conversation going, you can be in touch with us, rate and review the podcast on iTunes, send us an email at mailbag@standfirminfaith.com. Follow us on social media. Join the Anglicans for the Gospel Facebook group. Thanks to J.D. Koch and Matt Kennedy. I'm Nick Lannon, and Lord willing, we'll be back next week. Until then, by the grace of God and Jesus Christ, we'll be standing firm.